All right, well, we are into Judges chapter 5 tonight, and a pretty exciting chapter, one that isn't discussed very much from the pulpit, and so a very interesting study. We are in the third cycle of apostasy, falling away from the truth by the children of Israel. This is Deborah's the fourth judge, but she's kind of contiguous with Shamgar, as we learn in this song that they sing. And it's a glorious song that gives an amazing account of the battle between the Israelite forces of Deborah and Barak against the Canaanite forces of Jabin and his general Sisera. We learned last time we studied that Sisera had 900 iron chariots and an army, as well as all the weapons. The Israelites didn't have any weapons. They had been confiscated. In verse 8 of chapter 5, we learned that. And so, it was, against logic for soldiers to go to battle without weapons. Very brave thing to do. But nonetheless, 10,000 Israelites went up to Mount Tabor to await the Lord's deliverance. And as Bill taught us 2 weeks ago, they descended from Mount Tabor. The Lord won the battle. The Lord won the victory and turned over the Canaanites into the hands of Israel. And eventually, chapter 4 tells us, Jabin was defeated. So now, Deborah and Barak sing a song. Deborah, no doubt, who is the prophet, who's inspired by God, pens this song, and then they sing it together and taught it. I'm sure they taught it to people as well. So, question number one, Lauren, correct me if I'm wrong, but would it be Cole?
Yes.
Cole has question number one, which is, why does the Bible record the songs of these individuals? Could they be inspired pieces of poetry? How does the song of Deborah and Barak compare with the other recorded songs in the Old Testament? And how were they sung?
As for the first part, the Bible puts pretty great importance on songs and singing in general. The longest book of the Bible is the Psalms, which is a collection of songs. And because, for two reasons, because songs are something that really resonate with the heart of people, it can really get emotions for people, I guess. And they're also a great source of prophecy. I like the theory you point out in the home study that when verses 10. Yeah, this is verse 10, where it says, speak, you who ride on white donkeys, who sit in Joseph's attire, and you walk along the road, that can be prophesying of Jesus. So, I think that's why this was recorded, because it's a song of prophecy, and it's also, another point that I almost forgot to mention, was it mentions the Kishon swelling up, and that was how they won the battle. That was their salvation from the battle. So it teaches a biblical concept of salvation through water. And then as for could they be inspired pieces of poetry, I'd say yes, because Deborah is a prophetess. And how's this song compared? You said that it was very similar to the song sang by Moses after the people were delivered from the Egyptians to the Red Sea.
Yes.
Exodus 15. A parallel between the Red Sea swarming the army and the Kishon causing the mire and the chariots. Right. And as for how were these songs sung, you mentioned that it was pretty unclear, but it could have been in the synagogue that they had a Day of Deborah, something like that, a Day of the Song of Deborah, and they sang that.
I had a map.
I agree, Cole. Thank you. Here's a map of the events, the battle. Here's Mount Tabor, southwest of the Sea of Galilee. And the 10,000 went up to this mountain, came down, as Bill told us, to this the plain of Jezreel, Esdraelon. And here's the Kishon River. And they encountered Sisera and his army in this area.
Very good. Other thoughts on question number one. Yes, awesome.
As far as how the songs were sung, most smart people on these types of things seem to think that they were antiphonies, where you have one group that sings and then another group responds to that which is sung. And that seems to be a common theme in songs of the Old Testament, and I think even when you get to Revelation, Revelation chapter 5 being one of those where you have one group that sings in praise and then another group that answers, chapter 5, which is 12, 13, I think is where that's found.
Just
look at that real quick, because I think it's very similar to what probably is going on here. So in Revelation 5, verse 12, it says, and this is the living creatures in verse 11, many angels around the throne, the elders, the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000, thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing. And every creature which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth, such as are in the sea and all that are in them, I heard saying, blessing and honor and glory and power be to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb forever and ever. So there's a back and forth going on from one group to another, and that seems to be how perhaps this song is sung. We clearly see verses where Deborah alone is speaking, because she says, I, Deborah, rose up a mother in Israel. So obviously, Barak is not singing that particular portion of the song, but I think we can see other sections there where I think he is explicitly mentioned. He is, and we'll get to that here in a moment. But that's my thought.
Very good. Yes, and I love those thoughts. The Bible, as Cole pointed out, has much singing of the redeemed to the Lord throughout the Scripture. Praise the Lord, sing to the Lord, all the earth. David, of course, wrote songs to the Lord, and in Psalm 129, a song of victory, which is what this song is. Taylor has taught us about the Psalms of Ascents, 15 Psalms of Ascents that pilgrims would make on their way to Jerusalem. The Song of Moses in Exodus chapter 15, they sang the song. And Revelation chapter 15, the Song of Moses and the Song of the Lamb. So we need to keep in mind, as I think we do, but it's when we're singing in our worship service that we're doing the same thing. We're singing a song of victory. It's about praising God for his salvation that he has given us. And we praise the Lord in song just like Deborah and Barak did. And we have a much greater victory to sing about. Other thoughts?
Just a practical application maybe to that first. Why does the Bible record the songs of these individuals? You know, this was a special time. And there's so much negative written up. You know, let's get some positive and get it down on paper and be able to have people to reflect and share on this. So this would be an encouragement. I found a writer, he suggested that the theme of the song would be the joy and blessing in being a willing instrument of God.
Yeah, very good. All true. And it's sad that this learning this song by the Israelites didn't keep them in 40 years, as has been pointed out, in falling back into worshiping other gods. All right, question number two for Austin. How do these verses portray the time period? What scene is being described in 4 and 5? And what did they do right, specifically?
So, these verses, I think, are really, really helpful for us in kind of setting the stage for where Israel actually is before this battle took place. Because chapter 4 doesn't really get into that. They were rest and never rises up. That's all well and good, I guess, but this particular psalm, particularly when you get into verses 6 and 7 and so on, the highways were deserted. The travelers walked along the byways, presumably so that, because the highways were wrought with robbers, so they had to take other ways to get about. They were slinking about in fear. Village life ceased. And, when you think about village, I think we should think about community. And maybe you could just slip that word in here. Community life ceased. That camaraderie that people have together it was gone. It ceased in Israel until Deborah rose up as a mother in Israel. There was war in the, they chose new gods. There was war in the gates. There wasn't a shield or a spear seen among 40,000 in Israel. So all the fighting men had no weapons. They were completely stripped of all those things. It was dark. It was fearful. It was awful. And it's in those moments that then Israel remembered God, and then they cried out to him. And you can see why someone would do that, why they would cry out to God in these specific moments. And in kind of a twist on how the Bible usually talks about the rulers of Israel, usually it's they're shepherds of my flock, but they don't keep my flock. We read about that in several different places. I think Jesus upbraids the rulers of Israel probably more than anybody. And the rulers aren't often looked at in a positive way. But here it's different because they actually did rise to the call. And I really enjoy this alternate view, I guess, or this alternate take about the leaders. So it says there, so when leaders lead in Israel, when the people willingly offer themselves, bless the Lord. So the people were right there. They were offering themselves. And then, verse 9, my heart is with the rulers of Israel who offer themselves willingly with the people. So there is blessing upon, blessing bestowed upon these people, the rulers and the people, because they rose to the occasion. So it's kind of an unusual time for them. And there may be more, I think there is more that you have to say there on verses 10 through 12 there. And I'm anxious to hear that.
Well, I'll just do that. And it's unsupported by any commentator, so take it for what it's worth. But the prophecy of Jesus in Genesis 49 is that he would come riding on white donkeys, or on donkeys, not white donkeys. And he, of course, Jesus would be a judge and he would walk among men. Here's this prophecy from Genesis 49, speaking of the Messiah, Shiloh, with a donkey and a donkey's colt. So one of the first prophecies in Genesis, not the first, but one of them, is about Jesus and two donkeys. And then Zechariah mentions it in Zechariah 9. He says that the king will ride on a donkey and also on a donkey's foal, so two donkeys. And here's Zechariah mentions the battle bow being cut off, which in Judges 5 it says, far from the noise of the archers. So it's there's some analogy between Zechariah's prophecy and Judges 5 here. And then in Matthew 21, we're told that when Jesus did his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, he did indeed ride on a donkey and a donkey's colt. He was set on them. So it just occurred to me that while this could be speaking to the rulers of Israel who ride on donkeys, that's certainly in the most popular interpretation. It seems to me that it is also looking forward to the time when the Messiah comes riding on top. White means the conqueror. A white donkey means the conqueror who comes in peace. So it only fits with the Messiah that we know, because a conqueror comes on a white stallion in violence, but a peaceful conqueror comes on a white donkey, and then he's a judge as well, and he walked the roads of Israel, broke the battle bow, and the righteous come to the watering places and recount the acts of the Lord. And of course, water is mentioned as is essential for salvation. And then it says that then the people of the Lord shall go down to the gates in verse 11 there, I think. So then, when this happens, the people will go to the gates of Jerusalem, go to the gates of Zion, and will rejoice for the deliverance. So it just occurred to me that it may be that she is a prophet. Deborah's a prophet, and it's rare the Bible doesn't have at least some mention of the Messiah who is to come. Yes?
So, follow-up to that, I realize I didn't say anything about verses 4 and 5, which are actually quite pivotal to the whole thing. But actually, to kind of back up that this may be, or at least have some reference or maybe a picture towards Messiahship, would be actually verse 12, which I know isn't specifically covered here in this question. But it's that phrase, arise, Barak, and lead your captives away, O son of Abinoam. So course, Ephesians 4 quotes from Psalm 68 that Jesus led captivity captive.
Yes, right.
And gave
and some translations translate this verse. Arise, brought him captivity captive.
Yes. So I don't think it's out of the question to think that there's at least some picture of ultimate justice, ultimate deliverance being referenced here. And then just to finish up, verses 4 and 5, the picture that's being painted there is the fact that there is a great monsoon that happened. That's what helped in this victory. The earth trembled, the heavens poured, the clouds poured water. The mountains gushed before the Lord of this Sinai. And again, if you're on a mountaintop, which they were, you know, the water is rolling down the hills. It's very significant. This Sinai, I'm not exactly sure why it mentions that, because it's, of course, Mount Tabor, but perhaps just the giving of the law in view there, or the fact that the Lord is the Lord of Sinai, that this mountain is enforcing his supremacy.
I think she's opening with a description of the exodus from Egypt. And Mount Sinai, of course, was the part of that. And so she, and to back that up, turn over to Deuteronomy 33, because in Deuteronomy 33, we have almost the same words, very similar words, starting in verse 2 of Deuteronomy 33. It says, "The Lord came from Sinai, dawned on them from Mount, from Seir, and shone forth from Haran, with 10,000 of saints from his right hand, fiery law." And then it says, "Moses commanded the law." So language there that's describing the Exodus to Sinai with thousands of saints. Right, Deuteronomy 33, there's thousands of saints that went out of Egypt. And so what she's doing is she's going back to the beginning, showing how the saints were saved by water at through the Red Sea, and then they went to Sinai. And now the saints are saved at the Kishon. And then if you accept the Messianic interpretation of 10 through 11, the saints in the future will be saved at the water and praise the places church through baptism. So it's like she is giving a trifold: Red Sea salvation by water, current day salvation by Kishon flooding, and future eschatological salvation via baptism. It's kind of the way I look at it. Yes, brother?
Yeah, I like just want to comment on kind of some of the historical context that James E. Smith gave in terms of like what was the lay of the land like during this period of time. If you follow Israel during this period of time, you had the Canaanites had a huge influence at this point. They had moved in amongst the Israelites. The Israelites at this point had intermarried amongst the Canaanites. So basically, they had accepted all these pagan practices. Their religion was very diluted. They weren't men of courage. They weren't men of faith. They didn't have the strength of the Lord to back them up, to even take up arms and begin to battle against foreign invaders. They were very weakened at this point. That's why you had these different judges arise. Deborah arises and then gives them this renewed strength through faithfulness to the Lord. I actually agree with Alston here. I think at the beginning of this passage, it's opening up with the first section, giving praises to God, putting that highlight on there first, and then transitioning into the people that arose to the call of action, including the people that held very prominent places, so the white donkeys, the people that sit in judge's seat. It's talking about people that were in very prominent position. They didn't sit back in a prominent position, they actually took the call to arms. There could be dual meanings, and I would have to look into it.
And that's the major comment, as I tried to point out.
Yeah.
That's the primary interpretation. In fact, that's the only interpretation.
Yeah. So
there is no one.
This is the immediate context for sure, but yeah, if there's deeper prophetic meanings, I can see how that could be drawn out.
Very good. Yeah, and verse 8, as you pointed out, says they chose new gods, right? And I don't know if somebody mentioned that, but what a terrible thing to do as they intermarried with the Canaanites. Just Bill.
Yeah, I thought that Sinai reference in verse 5, I thought it was really interesting. And I thought back to verse 4, the earth trembling. You know, Mount Sinai was trembling and smoking, and it was scaring them to death. Now, there wasn't any, that I know of, any rain going on at that Mount Sinai event. But that reference to me, this is another Mount Sinai event. They're trembling and shaking. You know, there's big things happening here, so I like that a lot. That's
good. Very good. Yeah. Other thoughts on this really cool section? Guess we're not missing anything here. I love how Deborah describes herself as a mother. She doesn't describe herself as a judge or a prophet, but God's given role to her is as a mother, a wife and mother, and so that's how she describes herself. War in the gates, man, that's just hard. We can't even imagine that, can we? War in the gates, it's going on in the Ukraine right now. All right, I guess we should. Question three, which tribes joined in the fight, which did not? Is this a contradiction? And how does the song view tribes that didn't help, Bill?
Well, those that helped, Ephraim, West Manasseh, Benjamin, Zebulun, Issachar, Naphtali. The tribes that didn't help, Reuben, the other side of Manasseh, East Manasseh, Dan and Asher. And, you know, nothing said about Judah or Simeon. But I guess maybe by being so far south, maybe they weren't expected to come up and help. I'm not sure about that. I don't know kind of why that. Because that's that other map you had, I liked a lot because it showed the Kishon River going past.
Yes.
And that city that got cursed.
Meraz.
Yeah. It showed its location.
Yeah.
That's not that far from Judah. It was a lot closer to Judah than I thought it was. So I'm not sure why Judah and Simeon kind of get a pass on this.
Yeah.
It seems. That second part, is this a contradiction in chapter 4 in any way? And I wasn't really sure. I didn't answer that one. I skipped that one. Sorry, Austin. How does this song view the tribes that didn't help? I thought it viewed them as lazy, disconnected to Israel as a nation. There were no help whatsoever, not in a favorable light. So that's what I had.
Right. True. And so on this map, I try you exactly what you just said. I tried to highlight in color. So the red, Asher, Dan, East Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben all failed to show up, whereas the central green tribes did. And I put Judah and Simeon in brown because I wasn't saying anything about them. I didn't write the verse down, I wish I had, but in one of the chapters we've read already in Judges, it says that Judah drove out all the Canaanites. So these others failed to drive out the Canaanites, but Judah drove out all the Canaanites. And so is this God allowing Judah and Simeon not to take part because they drove out the Canaanites out of their land? I don't know if that's the case or not, but it's an interesting, why two tribes that are not included in this, not even mentioned. And you're right, they're pretty far to the south. So maybe that is what's going on. Other thoughts on this question? Yes, brother.
So there are some people that suggest the princes of Issachar, that it's possible that maybe Deborah herself was of the tribe of Issachar. She's, in other words, that she's not of Naphtali, even though that's where her primary post was. That's where she was judging the tribes of Israel. And as far as this contradicting chapter 4, I don't think it does at all. Because chapter 4 specifically mentions Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun. They were the main marching folk. Mm-hmm. And likewise, here in verse 18, it says, Zebulun is a people who jeopardized their lives to the point of death. Naphtali also on the heights of the battlefield. I think you can come up with much higher praise for a tribe than those two. So I think they were probably the main people in that, and the other tribes that answer the call, whether that's just their leaders, and that may be the case because it does talk about the leaders rising up and giving praise to them. Maybe they gave them help in some way. I don't know exactly how to harmonize that just perfectly, but I don't think it's a contradiction just because it only mentions two and it doesn't mention the rest, because obviously here in chapter 5 it mentions who else came. So I love this particular portion here, and I love to be able to look at a map and figure out who stayed behind and who came. And just this, you know, there at the end of verse 5, or verse 16, verse 15 and 16, talks about Reuben, how they had great resolves apart, but then why do you sit among the sheepfolds? Hear the pipings of the flock. The divisions of Reuben have great searchings of heart.
Yeah.
And that's just, I think there's modern application to that.
Remember what Jacob said about Reuben when he cursed Reuben in Genesis 49? He said Reuben would be as unstable as water. And so this seems to link into that because they sat around the campfires and debated.
No, we should go. No, yeah, we should go. We're on.
And then finally, the naysayers won. We'll all die. We don't even have any weapons. Forget it. So they're unstable as water. So they live up to their curse.
And I guess just in addition, the Bible views people of courage with great honor. Mm-hmm. Even when there's fear, and obviously there was fear,
yeah.
But they stood up to the challenge in spite of that.
Right. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
To think of climbing up on this mountain, here comes this other army, and you don't even have a weapon. So, pretty cool. All right. Dakota, what is the meaning of the phrase, they fought from the heavens, the stars from the courses, fought against Sisera? What are the waters of Megiddo? What role? And who are the inhabitants of Meroz, and why did they get cursed?
Yes, so multifactorial question. So the meaning of the phrase, I believe they fall from the heavens, the stars from their courses fall against Sisera. I believe this is specifically referring to divine aid in this case. This is God moving his hand against the enemy forces because make no mistake about it, these were enemies of God. Therefore, there was divine intervention to help these soldiers in this battle, which they obviously needed with no weapons in the situation they were in. What are the waters of Megiddo, and what role did they play in the victory? This refers to, let's find a specific verse. Yeah, the torrent of Kishon swept them away, that ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon, O my soul, march on in strength. So this is a divine event that happened in succession to the preceding verses where God actually brought on a significant amount of water through that body of water. Mm-hmm. That was typically pretty tame from what I understand.
It's a dry water.
So he really brought that to aid them. And the horses and the chariots were not able to basically take their normal course and get through those waters the way that they typically would, which significantly slowed down the enemy in that case. The inhabitants of Meroz. This is just basically a tribe that did not come to the aid of the soldiers, as we were previously talking about, and they're cursed for not doing so. Then, let's see. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, so the commentators point out that this Megiddo Valley right here, this plain, is an ancient valley of warfare. So the last place that you expect to flood, if you're a commander, is right there, Megiddo and Tanakh. This is the perfect place for chariots. And here comes the dumb Israelites down to the plain to fight the chariots. They should stay up in the mountain. Chariots can't go up in the mountains. Who in their right mind is going to come down into the plain to fight against chariots and cavalry and horsemen? As we read, there were horses too. And God, obviously, through Deborah, commanded Barak to do that. They come down, and then just as you pointed out, heaven, torrent, Kishon, maybe first time in its history, floods, and then the battle is won. So it's awesome. Yeah.
So I read an author trying to describe this battle, and he talked about Israel coming down from Mount Tabor. They're going westward. That the Lord's coming from Eden with all this Edom, with all this power and storm. It would have been to the back of the Israelites as they're marching forward. It would have been in the face of the Canaanites, intense rain, blinding rain, hailstones maybe.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, this could work.
Right.
You could see how, and now we have bogged down. I mean, think about four or five Israelites jumping a Canaanite and taking the sword away from him. I mean, it can happen. It can work.
Yeah, it's awesome. Incredible if somehow we could see those events. Now, as far as Meroz, nobody knows where Meroz was. All the commentators agree it's lost to history. And I like to postulate, so bear with me. Meraz may, because the very next verse deals with the wife of Heber the Kenite, who had withdrawn from, let's see, did I put any other slides in? I guess I didn't put any other slides in. Yeah, the Kenites were the descendants of the father-in-law of Moses, and they crossed through the desert with Moses as the eyes of the Israelites, and then they crossed over with Joshua into Judah. The Kenites did. The Kenites were with Judah, and I have those verses if anybody wants them after church. But one of them split away from the Kenites and went north and set up and made a treaty with the Canaanites. And this man should have known better because he was a descendant of Abraham. He should have known better to make a treaty with the Canaanites, but he did. And then he secretly spied on them, because it tells us that when the Israelites went up to Mount Tabor, this man, Heber, saw that, and he sent a spy to Jabin and told Jabin, the Israelites are gathering on Mount Tabor. So he stabbed his own brethren in the back. And that word, meraz, means secret. That's what it means. It means to withdraw or to be secret. And I think, because nobody knows, you can read all the commentators, nobody knows, I think the angel of the Lord is cursing Heber, the Kenite, for breaking away from the Israelites and supporting the Canaanites. And because the tribes have already been listed. All the tribes have already been listed. And now we're about to talk about Jael. So Heber gets cursed, Heber and his family, and Jael, his wife, is now praised. So that's why. Yes?
Not on that, but can I make an angel
sure.
of the Lord
oh, yeah.
comment? Why could the angel of the Lord curse Meraz? Michael the archangel couldn't even curse the devil.
Mm.
So is this just some angel? No.
Yeah, it's the Lord.
This is the Lord.
Right. It is the Lord who is cursing Meraz. And I think he's cursing these Kenites who knew better than to support Canaanites. Yes, we
like. To kind of take another view from what you just described, which I like a lot, this idea of Meraz, one of the writers I read from suggested it was a city or village near the Issachar-Naphtali border. So I'm not sure where that would put it. That might be about
somewhere, yeah. Issachar, somewhere
like
here.
You said, close enough to be able to spy.
Somewhere in this area.
Close enough to be able to have an eye on the people. And it didn't really make a lot of sense to me, but this writer suggested that this was a path for the escaping Canaanites. And that these people, the inhabitants of this city, failed to support Israel.
Right.
And in their lack of supporting Israel,
certainly, we know that for sure. Whoever these people were, whether they were Kenites or Israelites, they allowed the Canaanites. They didn't raise a finger to do anything. And they're cursed by the angel of the Lord for that. All right. My glasses just broke. Let's move on because we're getting low on time. Why is Jael regarded as most blessed among women? Were Jael's actions approved by God? Brother Larry? Okay. Trace.
So this is, we already talked about this a little bit, but this is one of those weird but sketchy kind of events. But it worked in Israel's favor, obviously. So in the last chapter, chapter 4, this was covered in depth. But the question says, why is Jael regarded as most blessed among women? Well, it's because she killed the commander of Jabin, king of the heathen Canaanites. That's probably why. Because that shows how much God disliked the Canaanites because of their heathen ways, their bigotry. There's not many women there mentioned as blessed. There's, you can go over to Luke chapter 1, verse 28. And having come in, the angel said to her, "Rejoice, highly favored one, the Lord is with you. Blessed are you among women." So, I mean, she obviously this is a good thing she did.
just according to the language that's in Scripture, I think God very much supported this.
Oh, yeah. Here's these verses I was talking about. Numbers 10, Moses said to his father-in-law, come with us, you be our eyes. So they were with the Israelites. And then Judges 1, the children of Hobab, the Kenites, they went up to Judah. And so they're there. They know all about God. They know all about the one covenant, the great I am. And they know about the Canaanites. And Heber, because he's an apostate, essentially, goes north and reports to Sisera what's going on. And his wife, Jael, isn't having any of it. She's not having any of it. And when Sisera wanders by, she goes out and lies to him, incidentally, and says, come in, my lord, come in. Save peace and safety. And she draws him into that web, and then she murders him. And the Lord approves. This is one of those situations where, Rahab the harlot, who said, I don't know where the Israelites are to the king, when she had them hidden on her roof. It's the same kind of situation. And the Lord values Jael just as much as the Lord valued Mary. So Mary brought the Messiah into the world, and Jael crushed the temple of the Satan figure. We were talking in our study about in Genesis 3:15, the Lord said to Satan that concerning the Messiah, that he will you will bruise his heel, but he will crush your temple. And so Jael is enacting that sort of idea here as she crushes the temple of Sisera. So in a way, there's more gospel. Jael, in a sense, is acting out the gospel of Jesus crushing the temple of Satan. So, yes.
I know we're running a long time, but I love this chapter. I think it's important to remember that Jael is not a Christian. And sometimes we look at these Old Testament passages and these Old Testament figures and say, ooh, well, that's morally questionable. Yes, it's morally questionable for Christians. We're not supposed to go around murdering people in their sleep. But I think it's important to remember this isn't murder. She's not killing Sisera out of anger or spite or just because she doesn't like him or because she's a psychopath. She is God's executor of justice and righteousness. This is divine justice that's coming about, a prophesied justice, that the victory of the day was going to be through the hands of a woman.
Yeah.
And like you mentioned, proto-evangelium there coming into place. So she's blessed not because she's a murderer. She's blessed because she executed the Lord's justice against pagan, heathen, awful, horrible people.
Right.
And that's what question six is all about.
Ehud killed Eglon. Shamgar killed 600. Gideon, Samson. I mean, these are men of violence, and here is a woman of violence who is willing to do the Lord's bidding. That's the Old Testament. And so, fortunately, things have changed in the Lord.
Real quick, I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago. We were talking about hospitality and having a responsibility, and that she violated all those things.
Right.
So she violated all these traditions, all that, you know what? She was doing the Lord's will, which was more important than traditions.
Right. And we're told that if someone does not come to you bearing the gospel of Christ, in other words, if they're apostates, you don't keep them, you know, you're not hospitable to them. So the same thing applies. So in before Christ, violence was acceptable, but during the time of Christ, disfellowshipping is our violence. We disfellowship those who are not faithful to the Lord. That's the responsibility that we have. All right, last question, because we are out of time. Why does this song take pleasure in the suffering, the poor mother of Sisera? And verse 31, is it the larger meaning? And let's see, that would be Lauren, yes, all right.
So I don't know that necessarily takes pleasure in the suffering of the mother of Sisera. I think this song tells a story of a viewpoint from the women involved in the conflict. So Deborah was wise and brave judge of Israel. Jael's a Kenite who joins Israel in killing Sisera, their enemy. And then the mother of Sisera, she gives her view. And it's shown from a wicked viewpoint of the Canaanites, or sons stealing the wealth of others and raping the women of Israel for his pleasure. So it's a two opposing viewpoints taking place in this. This verse 31 show us perhaps a larger meaning of this account of the deliverance in chapters 4 and 5. So I think we talked about it earlier, that it's a song of victory. The enemies of God will always be defeated, and his kingdom will eventually shine forth like the sun. And so we've got a couple verses that I think reflect this a little bit. Daniel 12:3. And those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like stars forever and ever. Matthew 13:43. The righteous will shine forth as a son in the kingdom of their father, you.
Very good. Yeah, I love your comparison of this chapter is really about three women. It's about Deborah, the godly prophet and judge, Jael, the woman outside of Israel who desires to be inside Israel. That's what her story is like. Again, Rahab the harlot. She's outside of Israel, but she wants to be inside Israel. And then a wicked woman of the Canaanites who finds it acceptable that women are raped and that she gets loot. She wants her son to come riding up on his chariot and come bearing loot for her. And so, unfortunately for her, the next thing that came riding up was not her son and the army, but it was the Israelites, because the Bible tells us they destroyed Jabin and the Canaanites, and so things most likely did not go well for Sisera's mother. Gruesome chapter, but also an awesome chapter. I think you can tell I enjoyed it quite a bit. It was the Lord, the victory of the Lord is firm and secure, and aren't we blessed that we have Jesus who did no violence, Isaiah 53. And it helps us understand a little bit about why the Jews had so much difficulty in accepting Jesus, because they were used to this. But even their own prophet, Isaiah, had said that when the Messiah comes, he will do no violence. And that's not the kind of conqueror they expected. And so they misjudged and mischaracterized the Lord.